Today is Friday, the 30th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. A new study finds that past vaccine efforts in low and middle income countries has saved millions of lives.
They included diseases such as measles, hepatitis B, human papillomavirus or HPV, and yellow fever.
Plus a bleak report on the security situation in Afghanistan following U.S. and NATO withdrawals.
Seems like every time it comes out with a report, it's more bad news.
And what makes Arches National Park special? We'll have these stories and more next. A new study shows that vaccines given in the last 20 years against 10 infectious diseases could prevent 50 million deaths in low- and middle-income countries. That success is expected to continue, with a further 47 million deaths predicted to be prevented by vaccinations given between 2020 and 2030, provided that progress is sustained. However, there are fears that the coronavirus pandemic has stalled progress. There are likely to be delays in vaccine activities as health services are disrupted. Henry Ridgewell starts us off.
An emergency vaccination drive in the Democratic Republic of Congo after a measles outbreak in 2020. Efforts like this have saved millions of lives, says a study. Researchers looked at vaccination programs over the past two decades, targeting 10 infectious diseases across 112 low- and middle-income countries. They found that some 50 million lives, mostly those of children, had been saved by vaccines. They included diseases such as measles, hepatitis B, human papillomavirus or HPV, and yellow fever. The research was led by the Vaccine Impact Modelling Consortium, funded by Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Dr. Katie Gaythorpe of Imperial College London is one of the report's authors.
If we continued with the vaccinations in our projections, so beyond 2019, we'd avert another 47 million deaths. So huge numbers. And what we wanted to kind of show in this paper is this is what we projected vaccination to look like before the COVID pandemic. And wanted to emphasize, you know, these long-term effects, these long-term benefits of vaccination going into the future.
Immunization programs have added benefits beyond the prevention of specific diseases. Again, Dr. Katie Gaythorpe.
For example, if people aren't getting sick of vaccine-preventable diseases, then that means there's less stress on healthcare due to those infections, which means you could potentially be treating people for other things.
But the researchers warn that the COVID-19 pandemic has disrupted vaccination programs and could lead to a decline in coverage. Again, Dr. Katie Gaythorpe.
We've got not only healthcare services stretched by possibly treating people infected with COVID, we've also got people's personal choice. You know, they might put off going to seek an immunization just because of fears surrounding being infected with COVID.
The World Health Organization in April launched its Immunization Agenda 2030 to try to get vaccine programs back on track and reach even more people. Kate O'Brien is the WHO's Vaccines Department Chief.
It would mean reducing by half the children who are completely left out of essential vaccines, the zero-dose children. It would mean achieving another 500 introductions of new and underused vaccines in low- and middle-income countries.
Scientists say the huge number of lives saved demonstrates the stunning advances of modern medicine and the importance of keeping other vaccine programs on track despite the COVID pandemic. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
On Wednesday, VOA's Haiti Adams, the host of Straight Talk Africa, spoke with Akuna Cook, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. Ambassador Cook laid out the U.S. plans to help African nations beat the COVID-19 pandemic.
Madam, these are difficult times all over the world. In Africa, only about 1% of the continent's population is fully vaccinated. Please tell us more about what the United States is doing to get much-needed vaccines to African countries and where those doses are going first.
Well, Haiti, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you, particularly talking about this topic of ending the COVID-19 pandemic, which is a top priority of the Biden-Harris administration. The president has been very clear that we have to approach vaccine contributions around the world with the same urgency that we have here in the United States. And so we are working tirelessly to get out this first tranche of 25 million doses to Africa. We have already, in the past 2 weeks or so, donated the first 5 million doses into 16 African countries. Burkina Faso and Djibouti were among the first. But there's many more coming. And in fact, this weekend, we will be delivering the largest sum of doses to any country, to South Africa at 5.6 million doses, and then to Nigeria at just over 4 million doses coming up. And so this is just the beginning. These are the initial tranches. We remain the largest contributor to COVAX and are committed to getting vaccines out as quickly as possible, because we know that we cannot end this pandemic anywhere until we've ended it everywhere.
And of course, dose sharing is critical for those most at risk. You mentioned South Africa. We see the situation there. And of course, countries that are heading in that direction as well. The World Health Organization says Africa needs about 200 million doses to vaccinate 10% of its population by September this year. Is the United States prepared to do more? Is this a once-off donation? Of course, nobody wants to look a gift horse in the mouth here. Countries need as much as they can get. But will the United States down the line be prepared and ready to give more?
So our vaccine contributions are, you know, they're multi-tiered and multi-layered, right? So these initial this initial tranche of 25 million, it's the first step. But we are also doing other things, including supporting vaccine manufacturing on the continent. And so we have invested in vaccine manufacturing in South Africa and in Senegal to ensure that Africa can then produce its own vaccines moving forward. We are also providing economic assistance to countries that have been impacted by COVID-19, with over $541 million in assistance to respond to the economic after effects of the pandemic. And so this is just the beginning. This is an initial tranche of our assistance, and I'm sure that we will see more rolling out over the next couple of months.
Ma'am, something we are seeing in the United States, and something that is very prevalent across the African continent, is misinformation around vaccines. There is a lack of trust, as people feel that in the past, Africans have been used as guinea pigs for scientific experiments. And of course, there is an element of that here in the United States as well. What is your message to people in Africa about taking a vaccine coming from the West? How can they feel safe to trust the vaccines?
Well, you know, what I will say is we absolutely acknowledge that there have been past reasons for there to be mistrust here in the United States and around the world. But it is absolutely the case that these vaccines are safe and they are effective. And we are working to disseminate best practices, including working with trusted messengers to get the word out that these vaccines are safe and that they are effective, and that it's absolutely critical that populations around the world, including here in the United States, avail themselves of these vaccines so that we can end this pandemic once and for all.
Deputy Assistant Secretary Akuna Cook, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Haiti.
Tokyo officials reported a record high number of coronavirus cases Thursday for the third straight day as the Olympic Games in the city continue. Japan's health ministry reported 3,865 new cases, nearly 700 more than what were reported on Wednesday. Tokyo's governor also warned that cases could climb to as high as 4,500 a day. In Israel, officials say that they will begin administering a third shot of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine to people over the age of 60. And in Australia, Sydney reported the largest single-day numbers of COVID-19 cases and warned that things could worsen. Elsewhere, health officials in Myanmar's prison system say that they have vaccinated more than 600 inmates against the novel coronavirus. It's part of a drive there to protect inmates from the pandemic and comes as military authorities struggle to control infections. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The UN Children's Fund is calling for an end to COVID-19 school closures, which, it says, are harmful for children's well-being and future prospects. Lisa Schlein is up next.
Schools in the Northern Hemisphere are closed for summer holidays. Elsewhere in the world, schools remain closed because of the pandemic, depriving more than 600 million children of an education. The UN Children's Fund reports nearly half the countries in Asia and Pacific have been closed for more than 200 days during the pandemic. Lengthy school closures also exist in Latin America and the Caribbean. And recent estimates show 40% of all school-aged children across Eastern and Southern Africa currently are not in school. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says these school closures are adversely affecting children's physical and mental well-being.
What this looks like, and we've learned this over the past year from the data, is that education and safety and friends and food are being replaced by anxiety and violence and teenage pregnancy. Across the globe, in all continents, we're seeing child helplines, a good precursor to understanding kids who are reporting violence, seeing often triple-digit increases.
Elder says remote learning is simply not an option for at least a third of the world's school children. He notes more than 80 million children across East Asia and the Pacific do not have access to distance learning during school closures. In Eastern and Southern Africa, he says schools in Uganda were closed for 306 days because of the pandemic, topping a list of 20 countries with the highest number of days of school closures. South Sudan comes in a close second. He adds most people in these countries have no access to the internet, thus excluding the possibility for remote learning.
If that doesn't resonate to those in power, then the World Bank does have a report showing around, their estimate is about a $10 trillion loss in earnings for this current cohort of students over time. UNICEF firmly believes this cannot go on. There is clear evidence, as you all know, that primary and secondary schools are not among the main drivers of this transmission.
UNICEF is urging all governments to reopen schools as soon as possible and not wait for the teachers and students to be vaccinated. It says the losses experienced by children are too great for them to wait any longer to receive the education and learn the skills that can help them build a better future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Flash flooding has killed over 100 people in the Taliban-controlled area of Nuristan, a province in the northeast of Afghanistan. Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamas has the details.
The provincial government appealed to the Taliban to allow rescue teams into the area to help. The Taliban stated that their own rescue crews had been ordered to the affected area. However, it's unclear how equipped the Taliban are to deal with emergencies in the mostly rural areas under their control. Local reports suggest the village of Merdesh was particularly affected, with over 100 homes inundated by the floodwaters. Since the announced withdrawal of US and NATO troops from the country, the Taliban have swept through dozens of districts, seizing land and even taking control of key border crossings with neighboring countries. I'm Karen Chamas.
Despite a series of cautiously optimistic assessments by high-ranking US military officials and Afghan leaders, a new report by the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, or SIGAR, describes the situation in Afghanistan as bleak and warns that the government of Ashraf Ghani could fall after U.S. and NATO forces complete their withdrawal. Speaking to reporters early Thursday, John Sopko, the U.S. Special Inspector General, agreed there's still a chance for the Afghanistan government to turn things around. Michael Kugelman is deputy director and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center in Washington, and I began our conversation by asking him what he thought stood out the most in that report.
Well, you know, these releases from the CGAR, the Inspector General, it seems like every time it comes out with a report, it's more bad news, and it's almost become a joke around town. It's the worst possible news about Afghanistan comes through these reports. But I think that this notion of misplaced expectations, trying to exaggerate measures of success, trying to create a notion that success is possible in places where it's not, I think it's a very basic conclusion. But just the fact that for so many years and up to now, just the sense that there could be ways to look for silver linings where they don't exist, or try to find glass half full empties, glass half full views where they don't exist. So I think that very simple point of, the U.S. just not thinking about the war in the way that it should be thought about, and just being overly optimistic when that wasn't really realistic, so to speak. So for me, that's what sticks out beyond all the numbers and all the stats and all of that, that very basic point.
I wanted to ask you something else. John Sopko, the U.S. Special Inspector General, said that there was still a chance for the Afghan government to turn things around. In your opinion, taking a look at what's been happening over the last month on the ground in Afghanistan, what do you see as what needs to happen for the government of Ashraf Ghani to turn things around after the U.S. and NATO forces leave and really not only sustain themselves in office, but also kind of jumpstart those peace talks that have been really stalled for quite a number of months?
Well, I think that if there's one way that the government in Afghanistan can turn things around, it's by trying to make better and more immediate efforts to improve coordination between the government and military leaders. One of the many reasons why the military has been struggling against the Taliban is that there just has not been good communication, coordination between the two. The military is not getting the materials, the supplies, as well as the guidance and leadership that it expects to get. And obviously, if that can change, if you can strengthen that coordination, boost morale within the Afghan security forces, make more military leaders more confident about what they need to do, that could improve battlefield performance, and that has the potential to try to finally take some of the momentum out of these Taliban advances. And obviously, if you're able to put the Taliban on the defensive a bit and try to reduce these offensives a bit, that would then, I think, make the Afghan government more confident about going back into negotiations with the Taliban, because they would be able to be in a position to at least reduce a bit of the bargaining power and that the Taliban currently has in talk.
You mentioned going back to the discussion table and increasing the bargaining power that the Afghan government has. On Wednesday, Pakistan Prime Minister Imran Khan said that because the United States was leaving unconditionally, it kind of gave up any kind of bargaining power with the Taliban. Regionally speaking, what do you see as some of the major concerns of the parties that are there, given that the U.S. withdrawal will be completed, in fairly short order?
Well, I think that one of the most immediate concerns for many of the countries bordering Afghanistan are refugee flows. We've already seen, as the violence has intensified and the offensives have continued to pace in the Taliban, so many people, thousands of people being displaced across Afghanistan. And that's only going to get worse. And, unfortunately, the countries that traditionally have taken in the most Afghan refugees, Pakistan and Iran, have been increasingly hesitant in recent months and really in recent years to try to bring in refugees. And in fact, Pakistan and Iran have also sought to repatriate a number of Afghan refugees that are already in these countries. So I think that is going to be the immediate fear, as well as the broader concerns about cross-border violence and militancy and all that. But I think that this refugee crisis is really going to be the first major policy challenge for neighboring states of Afghanistan after the withdrawal is complete.
The Wilson Center's Deputy Director and Senior Associate for South Asia, Michael Kugelman. The top United Nations humanitarian official began his first official visit to Ethiopia Thursday amid a humanitarian crisis resulting from conflicts and natural disasters in the region. Martin Griffiths is visiting Ethiopia for 6 days during which he is expected to meet with senior government officials and representatives of humanitarian and donor groups. He also plans to visit the Tigray region to hear firsthand accounts from those affected by the fighting. The U.S. Senate is starting debate on a new infrastructure spending package after President Joe Biden and a group of bipartisan senators reached an agreement on it after weeks of wrangling over what to include and how to pay for it. The roughly $1 trillion package would add about 2 million jobs to the U.S. economy each year for a decade. The deal is one of Biden's biggest legislative priorities. A Palestinian man has died after clashes with Israeli troops in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that the man was shot in the head and chest during Thursday's clashes. The confrontation took place at a funeral of a boy who was reportedly killed on Wednesday. Israeli officials say that the military police is investigating the incident. A sudden drop in temperatures in southern Brazil has brought snow that accumulated on streets of cities where it's rarely seen. At least 43 cities registered either snow or freezing rain, and more could come. The last blizzard recorded in the country took place in 1977 with 1.3 meters of accumulation.
This is Science in a Minute.
Venus has been called Earth's sister planet. Earth evolved into a habitable planet supporting a wide variety of life. Venus, on the other hand, has been described as incredibly hot and hellish, with an average temperature of 471 degrees Celsius. A team of scientists led by the University of California at Los Angeles have been bouncing radar off the planet's surface for the last 15 years in an effort to precisely determine its day length. The scientists found that one day on Venus is equal to about 243.0226 Earth days, give or take as much as 20 minutes each day. The scientists say the planet's heavy atmosphere is probably responsible for this variation of day length. A year on Venus, however, lasts 225 Earth days, which means one day on the planet is longer than its year. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. There's growing international criticism of Israel following allegations that software from the private security company NSO was used to spy on journalists, dissidents, and even political leaders from around the world. A group of American lawmakers is urging the U.S. government to take punitive action against the company, which denies any wrongdoing. In Israel, some experts are calling for better regulation of cyber exports. Linda Gradstein brings us this story.
An investigation by human rights groups and media outlets charges that various governments use the Israeli company NSO's Pegasus program to spy on dozens of journalists and dissidents worldwide. NSO called it a slanderous campaign and refused to respond to any more media queries. The company says it sells its software only to governments for the purpose of tracking terrorists and criminals. But some Israeli analysts say the cyber tool could have been used against harmless civilians.
Sometimes there is exploitation and sometimes there is utilization, harm utilization of those cyber security and cyber kind of tools. And the question is, what do you do in those cases? How do you make sure that the other country that has the right to use suddenly your software is using it according to your terms of licensing? And this is where the problem starts.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett responded to a call from French President Emmanuel Macron, who was identified as one of the targets of the NSO surveillance software, saying that Israel will investigate the allegations. Some Israeli legal experts suggest that the Israeli government should join the Wassenaar arrangement, in which 42 countries have pledged to make military and dual-use technology more transparent. But the legal experts say that NSO should ultimately take responsibility.
It's not enough that you intend well and you wish your products to be used only in certain ways. When you sell products to governments with very questionable and sometimes very bad human rights records, I mean, this is in a way an accident that is waiting to happen. And I think NSO is also has to accept at least the ethical responsibility for what has happened.
Some cybersecurity analysts say the NSO affair has already damaged Israel's reputation.
We start to see the consequences and the damage that may be, first of all, to this private company, NSO, but also to Israel. And the damage may be not only in the cybersecurity domain, but also in the political and bilateral and multilateral layer.
Israel has reveled in its self-image as a startup nation, but the latest allegations show that advanced technology can also harm that image. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
I am Rachel Yoha. I am a park guide at Arches National Park, which is located in Moab, Utah. So Arches National Park actually started out as a national monument. It was designated on April 12, 1929 by President Hoover as a national monument. It was noticed for its, you know, outstanding rock features and unique geology by kind of prospectors in the area and people that were here. And it is a really fantastic place in terms of the geology, and that geology goes very far back, 300 some million years ago, when this area was created. And it was basically created by this salt layer. So the Paradox Basin, that is basically just kind of off to the east of us over in Colorado, was all full of this inland sea that was coming in. It was filling this basin. And then as the inland sea kind of retreated, this basin was full of salt water. It evaporated and left behind a layer of salt. Well, this happened numerous times, and it eventually built up this large layer of salt in this basin. And then we have kind of this uplift, the Uncompahgre uplift over in Colorado, and it starts dumping all this debris and rock on top of the landscape. And it kind of forces this layer of salt kind of into a big dome. It's starting to hit fault. We get this big dome of salt, but it's covered by miles and miles of rock. Then you get the Colorado River coming in, and all of its tributaries erodes this area down, shrinks that rock layer back down to where almost that salt layer is kind of exposed to the air, and you get these joints, which are basically these big, long, parallel vertical fractures exposed to the open air and the elements. And that salt dome eventually collapses, and that creates kind of the shape that Arches is today. We have, you know, the highest density of natural arches in the world. There's more than 2,000 documented arches in Arches National Park, but you're not going to see all 2,000 because some of them are very small in comparison to all those big ones that are, you know, the big landmark features. What excites me the most about arches, I think, is that there are absolutely opportunities for solitude and for quiet and kind of times of contemplation in the park. It seems very busy on the exterior. There's lots of people that go here a year, but there are definitely the opportunities to kind of escape the hustle and bustle of the park. You don't have to go too far off a paved road. Even, you know, you can come in the late afternoon or early in the morning and have these times where you feel like the park is yours and you're the only person there.
And that's going to wrap things up for us today. You've been listening to International Edition, on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.